Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Above Politics Show. This is Homer Fife, and once again, my normal co-host, Martin, is on vacation. But today I have with me another one of Above Top Secret's most excellent members and moderators, Nevermore. How are you today, Nev?
I'm fine, and folks, don't believe a word of what he's just said. He's dragged me in off the street at the last minute for this.
It's going to get a lot worse, Nev, because I'd like for the listeners to know that you're fairly well known for giving us a weekly roundup on European politics, so I'm assuming that today we can expect a really in-depth political analysis during the show. Isn't that correct?
If you're lucky, you never know. You never know. Certainly about European things, I might be able to, but let's see. Let's see how we go.
And I've also tasked Neff with giving us a roundup, too. So you're going to get a double whammy of Neff and a double whammy of me, because I, of course, will end the show with my rant. I know just how much all of you so love that rant. So what do you think, Neff? Let's take a look at the headlines. What do you think?
Go for it. Let's see what we've got this week.
Well, one of the things that I've got on my plate here is the bailout seems to be continuing, and I think it's up in the vicinity of $1 trillion now before it's over with. Have you heard anything on that?
From what I've seen on the board, didn't the Detroit car makers go to Washington and ask for some money and say, please, 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 bail us out because we're spending an absolute fortune on producing really bad cars, and we've all flown here in our private jets, and we want you to help us and stimulate the economy and help the motor industry.
Yeah, but now there's two ways of looking at that, Neff, because yes, they flew there in their private jets, and yet we've got a president-elect who's running around here with this gas-guzzling Cadillac double-armored super bullet-impenetrable limousine that's probably getting all of about, 4 miles to the gallon, or probably more like 4 gallons to the mile. So aren't we being a little hypocritical? I mean, these people own their private jets and they use them to fly around. If you really want to look at waste in the United Auto Workers, I'm sure that's something that we can discuss.
Well, yeah, I've noticed that there are people sitting there at the present moment in time not doing any work, having been laid off from the auto industry, but actually being paid for it.
Oh, yes, you're referring to the infamous Job Bank. Now, that is, to me, the most audacious thing I've ever seen in my life. And I understand that the United Auto Workers is a huge union, and it's their job to support and protect the workers. They're not protecting them, Neff. They're paying them $31 an hour to sit around and do nothing, and they can turn down jobs and remain on the job bank. Now, how is that protecting them as workers? They're going to lose their entire livelihood.
I see on the board a lot of negative comments about socialized welfare programs and things like that. Isn't that almost a private company giving socialized welfare to people that used to work for it?
You know, I've never actually looked at it that way, but that's exactly what it is. That's socialism in its finest form. That's a large organization taking care of people that aren't working to reap the benefits of themselves being taken care of.
So you'd probably know more about this than me being in the States, but how does this system work? And how can you be on that payout and when they offer you a job not take it? I don't understand that.
It's all written in the bylaws. The United Auto Workers has for years lobbied to get their workers more money. I mean, if you just take a look at this, the foreign automakers that are producing cars here in the United States, and look, folks, if I'm wrong with these figures, please send a UTU and correct me. Trust me, it won't hurt my feelings any, but the foreign auto workers, I believe, here in the United States are paying their workers an average salary of somewhere between $40 and $48 an hour, which is an astronomical sum, in my opinion. But the big three, Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors, having the United Auto Workers there, they are paying an average salary of $78 an hour, virtually twice what the foreign automakers are paying. And they're not producing a vehicle that is competitive with the foreign vehicles. And now you've got this job bank thing that's just come to light. I mean, who knew? Who knew that literally thousands of laid off auto workers, instead of drawing unemployment, which is what unemployment is for, are sitting on their butts watching television, drawing $31 an hour to do nothing. Now that's more, that's actually considerably more than I make, and I have to actually get up in the morning and go to work.
I was going to say, just working at like $31 an hour, it's about £15 an hour, which is probably more than I make as well. So they're not exactly suffering at the present moment for not working, which is, that's an interesting concept coming from a capitalist society like America.
Yeah, so actually I touched on this on the last show, Neff, and I want to see how you feel about this. So my opinion is, if the United Auto Workers wants to continue this sort of job bank program, then why not have the United Auto Workers step in, take their pension funds, and put the pension funds up as collateral to bail out the big three automakers? In my opinion, what that would prove is the United Auto Workers are betting on their own interests. They're saying, we want this corporations to work so that our people can have jobs, and we're willing to lay our money on the line in order to make that happen. I mean, how does that sound to you?
It's an interesting concept, because basically they'd be staking their futures on their production. Ooh, I don't think they'll do that.
No, they're not going to do that. You're right. But
I think they've been scared. So, I mean, the bottom line of it, though, when you think about it, is that this program is contributing to the decline of the companies that they could be working for. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of money, one way or the other. They'll get laid off anyway.
Yeah. I mean, let's say we go ahead and give them the $25 billion, which, look, it's going to happen. We're going to give them the bailout money. The United States cannot suffer the collapse of those three corporations. There's just no possible way. The $25 billion is going to be handed to them on a silver platter. It's just a matter of when and how much we make them sweat before we give it to them. So we give them $25 billion. They're going to continue to finance this job bank program and every other piece of pork that is just weighing these companies down. So my question is, how long is the $25 billion going to last, and when are they going to need to come back before Congress and ask for more money?
Well, it's not going to last very long. I mean, in order for them to become profitable and to compete with the likes of Toyota and the emerging Tata Motors in India, they're going to have to cut their overheads. And in order to cut their overheads, they're actually going to have to lose staff, and they're going to have to lower the production costs, and they're going to actually have to produce cars that people want to buy. That's a huge concept to grasp. And $25 billion isn't going to cover that at all. Not between three of them.
No. And I've heard it said about different states, and I believe even one of the state's governors, I think I said last week it was Minnesota, but I actually believe I was wrong. I think it was Alabama. But I do know for a fact that if they come here to South Carolina, this is a non-union state, and they build a factory here, and let's just say hypothetically they paid their workers an average rate of $31 an hour, what they're paying the job bank program. You have no concept, Neff, how long the lines would be of people lining up to get that job. People down here are making $10 and $12 an hour and thankful they have their jobs.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it, in some respects it's similar to the situation we had in the UK in the early 80s, where, you know, you eventually you're going to get almost migrant workers inside the US that will travel en masse to go where the work is. The thing you said about a non-union state, that's quite something to me. I'm actually, I don't know if you're aware, I am a steward for the public service union, Unison, in this country. So you have states where, what, unions aren't allowed? Is that right?
That's correct. And I'm actually in kind of a unique situation. Where I worked prior to coming to this state, and I'm not going to get into too much personal information. We've already talked about the name change thing, but the state that I was in prior to this is a union state, and we were union. Actually, we were just collective bargaining, which is the initial state. You being a steward, you'd know more about it than I would, but Mm-hmm. Now, up there, under the union, I was able to retire, take a first retirement, at the very young age of 41 years old. Down here in South Carolina, because each state has their own rules and regulations, unions are not allowed. There are certain areas where they have collective bargaining, but that collective bargaining is very regulated by the state.
So what's the reason for not allowing a union? I mean, over here, just to set it into context, it is illegal to prevent somebody from having a union. If you want to form one, you can do. There's a balance to that. It's illegal for unions to force people to join them as well. But what's the thinking? What stops people from being in a union? And what's the thought behind that?
My opinion, common sense. The unions had their place. Now, I don't want to cut on your union in any way, shape, or form, but I believe that the unions had their place a number of years ago. They protected us from things like child labor and women's suffrage and that sort of thing. So I think that they were very valuable and very needed during the period of time when they first came into major being with United Mine Workers and United Auto Workers initially. But now what's happened is they've become this huge dinosaur that exists solely for the purpose of existing. Most of the unions over here support their own political party, and this is a politics show, so I don't mind getting political here. Most of the unions support the Democratic Party. They're just huge creatures that have taken on a life of their own, and instead of just protecting the interests of their workers by facilitating success in the companies that they represent, they've become just these complete huge lobby interests. And in the States,
it's kind of the same over here. I mean, the union that I'm a member of, which is Unison, has its own political wing, and that political wing pumps funds into the UK Labour Party. Now, the problem with that is that the UK Labour Party has been in power here for the past, it's almost 10 years now, and in fact it's over 10 years thinking about it, and in that time, all they have done is cut back on public spending and pushed efficiency drives into the public sector. So the union's been funding the party that's been trying to kill it. And that's quite weird over here. So I can imagine in the States that there will be huge pressure, political lobbies in Washington for the automotive industry. So the unions there, I take it, they're almost fighting on the side of the company in some respects. Is that right?
Well, I think they should be, but we're really not seeing it. We're seeing kind of a tug of war here, at least in my mind. We're seeing the unions whose main goal, their outlined, specified goal, is to protect the workers' interests as they relate to the corporation, be it the mines, be it the auto workers, be it the police union. And in that aspect, that they have a wonderful goal. However, it's again turned into a beast that has a life of its own. The United Auto Workers now exist for the sake of the United Auto Workers. What we were talking about as far as them putting up their pension funds, that to me would be a good faith move on their part to show that they really cared about their workers, because if they keep doing nothing but keep promoting these job banks and doing nothing to help the corporations whose workers they represent, they're going to wind up finding themselves on a sideline with no corporations whatsoever. The foreign automakers will be over here making vehicles that we can actually afford that are good quality vehicles, and Chrysler, GM, and Ford will go the way of the Oldsmobile.
Which one's going to go bust then? I can't see Ford going to the wall, but I could see one of the other two, and I really don't know enough about the U.S. automotive industry to say, but GM, they sell in Europe as Opel, and sometimes in fact they started rebranding as GM over here. Which one's going to go? If you had to pick it, which one?
Chrysler. Chrysler has historically been financially beset with problems, and now General Motors, I don't see GM going because of the simple fact that prior to Toyota and their vast and rapid rise in the market, General Motors was the world's largest manufacturer of automobiles, one of the largest corporations in the world. Ford, I think Ford could go. Ford has some problems, just like the other two do. But there again, I'm going to go back historically, and I'm speaking out of pure ignorance here, Neff. I don't know what the statistics are on this, but Chrysler's been beset with financial problems since day one, well, since Lee Iacocca moved in and cleaned house and completely turned them around. And now that was an interesting time period in the automotive industry. Lee Iacocca goes to Chrysler. Then he lobbies the Congress exactly the same way they're lobbying them now, but instead of asking for a handout, what Lee Iacocca asked for was simply a guarantee on a loan to his company. And he was able to pay back that loan way before the specified period of time.
That's an interesting concept. And the American government actually gave him the loan. Because that can you see, the you'll have to forgive me, and the American listeners will have to forgive me. That's a very socialist way of doing things.
It is. Well, the handout's more so. I'm not opposed to the guaranteed loans. I mean, the United States has been guaranteeing loans across the board as long as I've been around. I mean, they're from everything from student loans to loans such as Lee Iacocca did. And they don't really give the loans so much as they just guarantee them. When I went to college, I subsisted on student loans for a large period of time I was there. My loans actually came from the Bank of America, but they were guaranteed by the federal government, and so I was able to get them with little or no credit rating.
Right, I see. You'll have to forgive me with this socialism thing. I've seen it on the boards mentioned quite a lot by posters from the States, and it's almost like socialism is a dirty word, and, you know, we don't talk about socialism, we'll brush it under the carpet and shove it in the corner, and my God, we don't do that, because the Russians did that, and that was really bad. And I live in the UK, and in a lot of respects, although we're a democracy, we're not a democracy, we are a monarchy.
Correct. You have a queen.
We have a queen. But most of our systems are socialized systems that were born after the Second World War when the country was rebuilding, and they've just been built on. So when I hear you say, well, the government is actually providing money for this, and the car manufacturers are providing money for this, and I see people write on the board that, oh, we don't want socialism, we don't do that with it. It's almost astounding that people don't actually realise it. And maybe that's the crux of it. People don't realise just how socialist some of it is. And although they'll knock it because they think that the word means something completely different, not actually the case.
I think that a lot of people are afraid, Neff. This country, right or wrong, was founded on core capitalist concept in which every single person here has the exact same opportunity to succeed. And it depends entirely on that person's willingness to work, his motivation to work, his ability to pull himself up by his own shoestrings and get out there and succeed. I actually consider myself to be somewhat of a success story, and none of that was given to me. And I think that you have some jealousy here because you have a lot of self-made people here in the country. We have fought, and I'm saying we because I consider myself among them, we have fought our entire lives to get where we're at right now, and now I enjoy a fairly comfortable standard of living. So all of a sudden what I'm seeing is our country is turning around and it's saying, you don't have to do that anymore because the United States will give you what you need. You don't need to work because we'll give you a welfare check and let you sit home and watch television. You don't need to work because we have a job bank and you can make more money than Homer makes getting up every day and going to work. You don't need to buy food because we can give you food stamps and we'll really help you out. You don't need to make your mortgage payments because Barack Obama wants to spend $250 billion keeping people from being foreclosed. And let me tell you something, that foreclosure is a horrible thing, and I'm not going to get personal here, but I'm going to tell you that I have personal experience in that area. If you get foreclosed on, oh well, you pull yourself up by your shoestrings, you get back out there, and you work hard, and you get yourself back up to the standard of living that you want to live at. Mm-hmm. So I think some of it's not jealousy so much as just what right do these people have to live off the government, and what right does the government have offering to take care of them when I've worked my whole life to get where I'm at.
That's a perennial argument in the UK as well. I mean, our system's slightly different because we have like a socialised housing system, so that if you do lose your property for whatever reason, you can go to the local authority and say, I am homeless and can you put me up somewhere? And they will actually do that. I mean, I've been through that myself. I'm not going to get too personal on that, but I got divorced and I had nowhere to live and you know, that system's worked out. The argument still rages over here about, you know, people not working and getting handouts as opposed to people that do work. All I can say is, from my perspective, it's been difficult to pick myself back up and get back into it. Having said that, the ideal is the same over here as you've got over there. Do as well for yourself as you can, make as much money as you can, make yourself comfortable and get into it. The difference is that possibly our end result of failing to sort of, not failing, that's the wrong word, of being a victim of circumstances, probably the best way to put it, in this country, is slightly gentler than what you would get there, because if you're foreclosed there, then you're cut off, aren't you, almost, until you pick yourself back up.
Well, there's just so many social programs now that you're not really cut off, but there again, it all boils down to, if socialism truly worked, then why is there not a socialist state anywhere in the world that's successful? Now, there are quasi-socialist states, and I hear what you're saying, but England really isn't a socialist state. Like you said, they are a democracy. They just have a lot of social programs. France has a lot of social programs. Canada has social programs. I mean, the only socialist states that I can think of are like Cuba, and you have to ask yourself, how successful is that? It's just, and bear with me just a second on this little bit of a rant here, but socialism, to me, can't work because it flies in the face of hard work. And what I mean by that is, if I look around me and I have neighbor A to the left of me and he's not working because the government's taking care of him, and I have neighbor B to the right of me and he's not working because the government's taking care of him, and they both drive cars similar to mine and they have houses similar to mine and they feed their children and they don't do without, and we're all in the same economic boat, so to speak, the only difference is I get up at 6 o'clock every morning, and I get in the shower, and I leave for work at 7:30, and I work all day long, and I get home at 5 or 5:30, deadbeat, dragging myself through the door to eat my dinner so that I can watch a little bit of news, go to sleep, and get up and do it again. Every day I have to ask myself, why am I doing that? Why not just quit my job and let the government take care of me as well? And what if everybody did that?
I had that discussion with somebody once. A very serious discussion with somebody on that exact thing, and I think when it boils down to it, at the end of the day, it comes down to personal choice and personal responsibility and your conscience, really, and maybe that's the key to a lot of this now, is that people really don't care that much anymore.
Yeah,
and it's that's quite sad, but. Maybe that's what it is. Nobody's got the drive to... Possibly, I mean, I say don't care, possibly because they don't have to do it.
And the more these social programs come into play, the worse that's going to get. Neff, I don't know if you have any children, but I have a couple of girls, and I worked hard to teach those girls good work ethics, and I don't know how well I got through to them, because they're being raised in a generation of... holding their hand out, gimme, gimme, gimme.
Well, yeah, and the really odd thing about that is that the protagonist of that gimme, gimme, gimme happens to be a Republican presidency.
Oh.
And that's just, like, really weird.
Well, because you've heard the term rhino. I mean, to me, that's what George Bush was. He was a Republican in name only. He had some good, solid conservative values when he first started. But somebody or something got to him, or he got beat down. But whatever happened, his last term in office, and of course, to me, it was all defined with his stance on the illegal immigration. He turned, you know, he basically said, I don't care what the population of the United States wants. This is what we're going to do. And there were enough phone calls and enough petitions that we beat him down on that. But that, to me, defined his presidency from that point on, in my opinion.
Yeah, and don't you think, I mean, I don't want to get into it because I don't want to be accused of being a Bush basher, although it's already been leveled at me a few times. The war in Iraq has cost an absolute fortune when that money could have been put to different use. And also, and it's the same argument that I've put forward on my roundups about Gordon Brown. The people that are trying to sort the mess out now are actually the ones that caused it in the first place. And, you know, there's an awful lot of tightening up of regulations and finances that could have been done by the Bush admin, the same as it could have been done by the Blair administration when Brown over here was the Chancellor, to stop the banks from being so greedy in their markets and prevent a lot of the problems that we're seeing now. And they didn't do it, and now they've come up with these measures to try and rein it all back in. And I'll go into a few of those when I do my roundup of what's happening over here, because we've just had a pre-budget report that's absolutely crazy. But, you know, they've dug the pit, and they're trying to dig themselves out of it now, and all they're doing is getting deeper into it. And I just think that's tragic, really.
Well, to me, it's common sense. I mean, exactly what you're talking about, Neff. Right here in the United States, they've just lowered interest rates again. Where's the common sense in that? What got us into this mess in the first place, and people seem to forget, and no one's mentioning Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac anymore, but that was the spark that lit this entire keg of dynamite. And what happened was the United States government, in its infinite wisdom, decided that everybody should have a house. Every single buddy who lives in the United States has a right to their own domicile. And I don't disagree with that. What I do disagree with is everybody in the United States has a right to work for and earn their own house. But instead, the government comes in and does these subprime loans and says, okay, so what if you don't have enough money for a down payment? That's okay. We as a government, we're going to give you a subprime loan backed by Freddie Mae or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and we're going to put you in a house, and so what if you can't pay for it? That'll be okay. We'll help you out. Well, guess what happened? The bottom fell out, because you can't keep doing that.
It's a short-sighted view, and is that how Bush is going to be seen? I mean, just getting away from that. Is that how Bush's presidency is going to be seen in the long term? That it was a short-sighted one instead of a long-sighted one.
I think so. I think that's what's, and it's a shame, because I've always supported President Bush, and I still do. I think that he fought as well as he could fight, and the number of years that we had Republicans in the House and Senate and a Republican presidency, we actually enjoyed an economic boom. The problem was that economic boom was being supported by false economics and bad economic decisions. And then in 2006, the Democrats come in and take control of the House and Senate, and all of a sudden, everything starts to fall apart. You can't blame the Democrats. You can't blame the Republicans. It's a mix. Those decisions were made probably back during Clinton's time when they kept lowering the interest rates. And I'll give you another example. This economic stimulus, that's harmful to our country. Yeah, I'd like to get a check from the government. I love getting checks from the government. I love spending checks, spending money that the government gives me. But if they keep giving out these checks, it's going to stimulate the economy, but it's doing nothing to support the dollar. It's doing nothing to drop the deficit. It's doing nothing to help us in our overseas economic problem.
Yeah, it's a strange one. It's almost robbing Peter to pay Paul, and that's not going to work. There's some logic that says that some things, and it's hard logic, it's a very hard logic, in fact it's tough love really, that some things have got to fail in order for things to get better. And, you know, instead of trying to head it off, maybe the more natural events of letting things go to the wall and then having to rebuild again might be the way forward.
I think that either way, Neff, either way, we're looking at some very, very hard years ahead of us here in the United States. I support what you just said. I think that, like a razor's cut, the cleanest cut heals quickest. And if we let the market take care of things and let some of these businesses fail, start seeing some soup lines, start seeing some people that are literally lined up just to feed their families, then we'll recover from that. We did back in the 1930s, and we can do it now. What's going to happen, though, is we've got a Congress, we've got a Senate, and now we have a president soon to take office that wants to do nothing but support everybody and keep holding this up, more money to bailouts. President-elect Obama has just stated he's going to give $250 billion he's going to keep set aside to keep people from losing their homes. And that's just more. You're just adding fuel to the fire, which prolongs the hurt. It's going to prolong the pain. We're going to go into a recession, and it's going to be a long, drawn-out recession, if not a depression.
There is a way out of it for him, though. And I mentioned it in a thread today, and I apologize to the thread author because I can't remember who you were. But I actually put the comment in the thread. There's two words that can bail Obama out and actually bail the states out and possibly the rest of the world out of the problem that it's in. And those two words are hydrogen economy. Because in order to get the world moving again and to improve industry and get off the reliance on fossil fuels, valuable resource that we have is hydrogen, and it's possible to actually run vehicles on it and run power generation systems off it. And if Obama latches onto that and puts people to work putting that infrastructure in place, the man's on a golden ticket, and you know there is work there to do, and that could bail him out. Whether or not he's going to do it, I actually thought in his pre-election speeches I thought he was heading for that, and he's not made any sort of moves on it since. I don't know what your opinion on that is.
Well, my opinion, I have one word for you with hydrogen. Neff, then we need to move along here. We've been on this topic a while. When it comes to hydrogen, I want to say only one thing to you. Well, let's say two things. The first is the Hindenburg, and the next comment, and you'll understand what I mean, lines in the sky.
Oh, it's possible, though. That's possible. You can run aero engines off hydrogen. That's Lockheed Martin. They've been doing it for years. So
just,
you never know.
They just spray us with more chemicals.
Lines in the sky.
Yeah. All right. Neff, I found something on the net that I thought you would be absolutely fascinated on, and it's not so much in a political vein, but I think it actually bears talking about. On Mail Online, World News Daily, there's a title to an article that is titled "Hero Royal Marine Saved 130 Soldiers by Rugby Tackling Suicide Bomber." Did you see that?
Yes, and that just goes to show the difference between the Royal Marine and other units from various armed forces around the world that would probably have run away. Because this guy was made of the proper British stiff upper lip, sterner stuff, and instead of running like hell, he decided to grab the guy. Now, that's, you know, if you think somebody's carrying a bucket load of bombs, that's a fairly scary thing to do, and that guy's got some, what's the word they use on this one? Intestinal fortitude.
Yes, yes. This suicide bomber had 70 kilos. He had two bombs, each one 35 kilos in weight, that were packed onto a small, well, those little small 50cc bikes, like we call them mopeds over here. And
yeah.
This British Marine, just the gutsiest thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. I've never seen it. This man needs to be put up as an example of the type of young men and young women that we have over there, and I'm just speechless at it, and you should be just proud as you can be.
Oh, I am. I mean, the guy needs some sort of decoration for that, but he's not the only one. Did you see that case, well, I think it was last year, about the guy that at the airport in, I think it was Glasgow. Did you see that one? The guy had loaded his car up with fuel canisters and decided that he was going to drive his car into the front lobby of the airport and literally try and blow the place up with a car packed full of fuel.
Right.
it didn't work, basically. He plowed the car into the lobby and the car was on fire, and he was a bit on fire, and he decided that discretion was a better part of valor, so he was going to run away, and a member of the public ran up to him, after realised straight away what he was doing, a member of the public ran up to him, decked him, and then the police came and arrested him.
Now, see, and that's just outstanding.
That's British spirit for you. I see things on the board where there's a bit of, you know, oh, British Armed Forces this, British people this, you know. And there's two examples there where, actually, you know, when it comes down to it, the person that you can rely on most is an Englishman or a British person.
I'll say this, Neff, and you'll hear no negatives from me. You know I serve my country here. I had occasion one time to, and it's a little bit of a side note, to train with your British Royal Marines at a little small island right in the middle of the Indian Ocean. I will have to say they were some of the strongest, most hard-charging individuals I have ever personally gotten to know. I trained with the Navy SEALs a little bit too, and these guys were every bit as good as our SEALs. The only thing, and I'll have to say this, Neff, I don't think I ever talked to one of them when I didn't smell alcohol in his breath.
Well, that's all part of the service, that is, you. Hard fighting, hard drinking, womanizing, that's it, you know. That's what it comes down to.
Well,
why not, you know?
Yeah, exactly. If they keep producing guys like this Royal Marine, hey, I'm behind it. You said something to me earlier today, Neff, about a value-added tax over there. You want to elaborate on that a little bit? I think you're probably going to do some of that in your roundup, but I'd kind of like to hear a little bit about it.
Okay. In the UK, we pay value-added tax on just about everything, apart from certain foodstuffs. And we pay it on, well, from food to fuel, it's there. Services rendered, it's there. Major contracts, it's there. As part of the Chancellor of the Exchequer's pre-budget report, and they do this in November, and then they have the actual budget in April, but as part of the pre-budget report they do some tweaks, and because of the credit crunch, one of the ideas that the Chancellor of the Exchequer has come up with is to reduce the rate of value-added tax, and he's decided to reduce it from 17.5% to 15%, which initially sounds like a good idea, but there's a catch, and the catch is that cut has been made for 13 months and it comes into effect on the 1st of December. So basically every company and every supermarket and every small corner shop and every contractor, small business, you name it, that has to pay VAT has now got to go and reprice every single item they have for 13 months to make for the change. If you think about it, it sounds like a good idea until you realise that that's going to cost money. And that money is going to go on the company's bottom line, and that bottom line is going to go on the prices of the goods that they provide. So instead of there being a reduction in costs, the price could actually go up. Now, isn't that the craziest thing you've ever heard?
I've never heard of anything like that. I mean, but again, it's exactly what me and you were talking about. It's all about looking at the long term as opposed to the short term.
Well, that's it. It's a short term measure. There's an extra kink to this, because in order to facilitate the cut in the VAT rate, what the Chancellor's done is he has upped the tax, or the duty as they call it in this country, on alcohol, tobacco and fuel. Take the alcohol and tobacco out of it for a while, because you know, the government in this country is trying to kill off smoking, and they're looking to replace that revenue from somewhere. And the alcohol, if they push the way they're going with the drinking and binge drinking and whatever, they'll probably kill that one off as well. But there's something in the region of like 40 or 50 British pubs closing every day at the moment because people aren't buying beer anymore. The fuel thing is crazy, because to offset the VAT, he's put 2p a litre on the price of fuel. Now, we already paid VAT on fuel anyway. So he's taken 2.5 pence off the VAT rate, but he's put 2p a litre on the fuel. So he's actually going to make more money out of that. Not only that, but the VAT rate reduction is temporary, but the fuel duty increase is permanent. So at the end of the 13 months, the price of fuel will actually have gone up, and we'll be paying 17.5% again in VAT, plus the additional 2p a litre on the fuel, plus whatever he's going to put on in April, because if the oil price keeps coming down, he will then put fuel duty up again. They have this warped way of thinking that says, if the oil price comes down, it's okay to put duty on the fuel, without thinking that, well, actually, you know, the oil price may go up, it spiked. I mean, this is the daft thing. Actually, in the pre-budget report, it said oil prices have come down from £1.38 for a litre of unleaded to, it's just dropped now to about 94 pence, and therefore we can increase fuel duty. And that kind of irresponsible and frankly stupid thinking is penalising the drivers in the long term. It's penalising the haulage companies. It's penalising the, you know, goods going into supermarkets, because you've got your additional costs on top of the actual provision of the goods. It's a crazy move, and I can't believe they've done it.
Well, I think that there again, it's exactly what we were talking about before. It's a short-term fix for a long-term problem, and it's not going to work.
It's not. And you were saying earlier about possibility of being in recession for many years, that the government report is actually forecast, I do believe, that they are looking that the UK recession will go into 2009 and then start picking up again towards the end of 2009. And I think that's particularly short-sighted as well, because with the problems that have been generated recently, I can't see it happening that quickly in order for the economy to turn around. Plus, the amount of borrowing that the government's undertaken has gone up hugely, and they're hoping to balance the books by 2016, which is an awful long way away. And I can't see that happening either. I think that when this government goes out of power, and I think we're in a situation over here very similar to what you've just gone through in the States, where the government's been in probably for too long and we're looking for a change. When the next government comes in, I think it'll be a Conservative government, they're going to have a hell of a mess to sort out.
I couldn't agree more. And Neff, we've just about run out of time.
Already?
Already. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
It certainly is. Can I have a couple of seconds up for a rant?
You British people always want this just a few more seconds, don't you?
It's what life's all about.
Yeah, feel free. Rant away.
Okay. This is Neffamore with a message from your cousins across the pond. The election in the States is over. It's done with, and it's finished. And whether you like it or not, it appears that Mr. Barack Obama is going to be the president of the United States of America for at least the next 4 years, barring unfortunate incidents. Please, get over it. It's done with. It really is done with. It's getting tiresome. Thank you.
Actually, Neff, when you started that, I thought I'm going to have to hit the mute button. But thank you for keeping that as well as you did.
I kept it as brief as I can. I could say more. The only other thing that I could say is, if you're going to carry on down the lines of polarization and taking smear pot shots at each other and in your political system, then just give the country back to us and we'll run it for you.
Neff, that's going to be it for us today. Look, thanks for being on.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you.
And everybody stay tuned. We're going to have a roundup from Neffamore. So you're going to get a full dose of Neffamore today. We're also going to have a roundup from Expert 11. He's going to give us a segment. And if you stay tuned, there's either going to be a Homer rant or a crossfire between myself and Chisler. And the topic of that discussion is going to be Guantanamo Bay, keep it open or shut it down. And Neff, once again, thank you for being on the show. I truly appreciate it. It's been a blast.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
It's the same dream night after night. I hear this beating, this rhythm. I'm wandering like an unfulfilled lost soul through this misty haze. But I keep following the sound. It seems like I walk forever. In the distance I see something beautiful, magnificent. It seems so far away, yet so near that I could reach out and touch it. As I approach closer, I can see millions of people, all ages, races, religions, philosophies. People from around the world and from every nation on terrestrial Earth. They're moving in mass towards something mystical, magical, magnetic. As I follow them, all of a sudden they begin to create a path for me to walk through. I can see something massive on the horizon. As I get closer, I see a banner unfurling in the gentle wind. It says, "Welcome to the revolution." The crowd begins cheering and celebrating. I'm so overwhelmed by the experience that I wake, still hearing the beating of the heart. And then my dream becomes crystal clear. I have found my holy grail. My thirst is quenched. My lifelong quest finally achieved. I have found AboveTopSecret.com. And my beating heart joins theirs. I have become a member. Welcome to our revolution. AboveTopSecret.com.
Hi, Homer, and, well, me, and everyone in podcast land. This is Neff with the UK Roundup. Politics in the UK has been dominated this week by the Chancellor's pre-budget report. For those unaware of how this works, basically the UK Chancellor has two bites of the cherry each year to set fiscal policy for the government. The main budget comes at the end of March each year, which is in tune with the UK financial sector's end-of-year returns, but before then, adjustments are made in November of the previous year. With the global credit crunch affecting the UK economy, the Labour government has attempted to try and instill some life back into the consumer market with policies set out in this year's pre-budget. Some of these changes include lowering the rate of value-added tax from 17.5% to 15% for 13 months, and listen to the main show for my thoughts on that, increasing the rate of duty on alcohol, tobacco and fuel, proposing an increase in individual national insurance contributions, which are the things that pay for our healthcare and pension provisions over here, from 2011, introducing a 45% income tax rate for people who earn over £150,000 a year, and incentives for homeowners to become more energy efficient and cut fuel bills. Look deeper at the proposals than surface gloss, however, and you will find that the measures put in place actually inflates costs for retailers, who will need to adjust their pricing, adds a permanent tax duty onto fuel, which negates the effect of the VAT decrease and falling oil prices, and also penalises hauliers and the general public should fuel costs rise again to the levels we saw earlier this year, and gives no incentive to successful business people to remain in the UK when they can pay tax elsewhere. Boom or bust, anyone? Breaking news today is that it appears Labour actually produced a report hinting that VAT will be increased to 18.5% at the end of the 13-month lower rate. The Conservative Party are having a field day with that. And there'll be more on that from me next time. But that's all from me for now, so back to Homer and, well, me in the studio.
Hello everyone, this is Homer Fife. My partner Martin Bain and I are the hosts of the Above Politics show here on AboveTopSecret.com, alongside Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous with the ATS Mix, and Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock with the BTS Mix. We've worked it out so that all of you can subscribe to each and every one of our shows. Now, on each show thread, you're going to find two shortcuts where, when you click them, we'll whisk you away to a place where you can then download the shows with iTunes or with our RSS feed. And always remember, it's your subscription that helps bring our intelligent community to the entire world. So join us all in Deny Ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Johnny Anonymous and Dave Rabbit. Listen and Deny Boredom with the BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock. And Wake Up and Deny Apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and yours truly, Homer Fife. Be a part of the revolution, a part of the Above Network, LLC.
Welcome to my worldview, where I'll give my perspective on some of the important events that have taken place around the world. I might as well start with John Key's visit to APEC in the UK. At APEC, the newly elected New Zealand Prime Minister virtually turned on his own when he blamed those responsible for the likes of hedge funds for the economic mess the world is in. Key also pushed the case for reducing barriers to free trade to be lifted in order to help get the global economy moving again. After leaving APEC, Key drove off to the UK to meet Gordon Brown, the Queen, and as is customary, a meeting with opposition leader David Cameron. The main issue of contention between the two leaders being Key and Brown, that is a $200-odd increase on the passenger levy for those who are travelling to New Zealand. Tourism is a very important, if not vital, part of the New Zealand economy. Brown and Key also swapped notes in respect of G20 and APEC meetings. While he was in London, Key, in his dual role as tourism minister, took part in a promotional event that was promoting the 2011 Rugby World Cup, which will be held in New Zealand. On a much lighter and pleasant note, Key also took the opportunity to meet his half-brother from his dad's first marriage for the first time. So for once in a while, investigative journalism has sent up what would be termed a human interest story that has had a positive outcome. This being Key's first trip overseas, there's nothing to judge it against. Before I head on to other global events, there is one other thing of note that I will deal with. Kiwis who have been following events overseas may have noticed that for 13 months there will be a 2% reduction in the value add tax, the UK version of GST. This is being offset by tax increases on high income earners. Aside from giving the people who are running businesses headaches and penalising those who are successful in general, I don't see how any of the stimulus packages worldwide will be beneficial until confidence is restored in the credit market. Moving across the Tasman, one item of interest caught my attention. We generally try and gain some ground on Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in the polls. Opposition leader Malcolm Turnbull has suggested the idea that shareholders' votes on directors' pay should be binding. The move strikes me as a classic ploy from an opposition party. The only advantage to being in opposition is that a party can suggest policies that they don't have to worry about implementing. The next two events are still developing as I record this piece, so the final outcome and my final conclusions are both unknown at the time of recording. Terrorists have struck in My apologies to the listener. That little interruption was caused by my kitten Georgie, who must be saying that she disagrees with everything I'm saying. Now, where was I? Terrorists have struck in Mumbai, if that's how you pronounce the place. The death toll currently stands at 101. The target was clearly Westerners, with American and British tourists being held hostage in the hotels they commonly frequent. Rather than the use of trademark suicide bombings, the terrorists use grenades and some form of firearms. My view on this is fairly straightforward. Not an inch should be given towards those who have committed this act, and that a result to see democracy and the enemy being given No havens anywhere must remain resolute. No Kiwis have been reported as killed or taken hostage. Staying in Asia for a moment, anti-government protests in Thailand have shut down both of Bangkok's airports. So far, Kiwi travellers and people from other countries have been more inconvenienced and harmed. Despite a district court ruling that protesters have to leave, they have remained at the airports. Protests have taken part in other parts of the country as well. In part, the protesters are demanding that the Thai parliament be appointed rather than elected. Accusations of corruption and vote buying have also been made. Thailand remains a country very much divided. Myself, I oppose the idea of a minority having control over the appointment of leaders anywhere because it is undemocratic. The final issue I will deal with is piracy. In recent memory, piracy has mostly been concerned with illegally downloaded music and software. Now we are seeing a rise in piracy at sea, particularly in the vicinity of Somalia. Now this is bugging the hell out of me, because the fix is obvious but not being implemented. Clearly an adequately equipped convoy system with air cover, the same thing that defeated the U-boat, is the answer. Once the pirates can no longer hijack ships, they will turn their criminal ways to other activities. Port security would have to be addressed as well, but again, harbour patrols and other measures not seen for 60 years would go a long way towards helping the situation. For every two things that change, one thing will always remain the same. Oh yeah, and the other pet peeve I have about this situation is that the shipping companies that will likely fork out for mercenaries could spend what would probably be a fraction of the cost on employing a few more crew members to keep a better eye on proceedings. While the organised criminals that are committing acts of piracy are not in the same league as Al-Qaeda, the measures I have described would also help prevent terrorist attacks against shipping. Well, that's it for my worldview. Thanks for listening.
Hello everyone, this is Homer Fife, and I'm sure you're aware this is the Above Politics show. This week, we have an interesting added feature. Our guest host from last week, Chisler, is back with us. How you doing, Chisler?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm just fantastic. And he had an interesting thought process last week on the closing of Guantanamo Bay and how it could possibly affect President-elect Obama's presidential future career, so we thought that we would get together and do a little crossfire with you, at the end of which I will post it in the show, and you, the listener, will be encouraged to jump on the show thread and tell us what you thought of the basically online debate. And yeah, that's right, who won? That's what we're looking for from you people, so everybody listen up, and we're hoping to have some fun. Are you ready to go, Chisler?
I am ready to go, my friend.
Now, you do understand that being the seasoned professional debater and seasoned co-host that I am, that you are in deep water.
I'm more than prepared.
All right, then. Chisler, the ball's in your court.
Appreciate that, and I tip my hat to my worthy opponent. Again, I see this as a simple issue, which some people may disagree with, but Guantanamo is certainly a polarizing issue out there today that I think some people will disagree with where I'm coming from on the issue, that I do believe that early in Obama's administration that he should go ahead and close the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay. My reason for believing that it should be closed is quite simple, and that the denial of basic human rights is being denied to citizens of any nationality or anywhere on this earth, regardless of what I'm guilty of. I am of the mindset that everyone has entitlements and rights that should never be denied, regardless of their actions. And I am of the mindset that at Guantanamo Bay, certain prisoners, well, all prisoners, are being restricted of these rights. With the current administration of George Bush that has established this Guantanamo, or Gitmo as it's commonly referred to, since, I believe, 2001, almost 800 people have been put through there. How many of those have been actually given their day in court, and how many have been actually faced the justice system and given a crime that they are guilty of or told why they are being held. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but I'm willing to state that it is certainly a minority. So to hold a citizen of this earth against their will and not even give them the opportunity to face a court of law and plead their innocence is just not something that I think, you know, we as citizens of this whole earth should be guilty of. I think that we've evolved to the point where we have developed justice systems where we should be allowing people to have their day in court and face the crimes that we are accusing them of. So with that ramble, I will offer it back to my astute opponent.
Very good, Chisler. However, I have some problems with what you said, and I intend to illustrate those as we go along here. First and foremost, you're talking about the human rights of the prisoners. These human rights that these prisoners have, or possibly could be construed as having, they gave up the day they decided to take up arms and fight against the United States. Here's the problem. You want them taken before the justice system, you want them tried, and you want them put somehow or another in our system of defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys and judges. The problem with that, my dear friend and esteemed opponent, is they have not committed a domestic crime within the United States. These people are war criminals. They are terrorists who have committed acts of war against the United States, and they are being held as war criminals. And as such, they are not given, and they have no rights to the wonderful system that we have here in the United States for trying people that commit domestic crimes. They gave up those rights when they picked up arms and they decided to combat the United States. We are at war. It's that simple. And I don't want to use that quote from Battlestar Galactica, but it is a fantastic quote. Gentlemen, we are at war. And in that war, you're going to have casualties of war. Some of those casualties of war are going to be prisoners. These prisoners are being held in Guantanamo Bay because we don't want them held in our backyard. I certainly am not going to give a spare room up to hold to house one of these prisoners. They can't be turned back to their own countries because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that very same issue came up with several of these detainees this week, in which we were going to turn them back over to, yes, that's correct, folks, there are Chinese there. We were going to turn them back over to that country, but we couldn't do it because if we did, they were going to be tortured and probably beheaded, which is a violation of the human rights that we're protecting, so we left them there. Now, that's, and of course it begs the big system, or begs the big question, I'm sorry. The big question that we were begging here is, if we close Guantanamo Bay, and I'm going to leave my opponent with this question, if we close Guantanamo Bay, where do we put the 270-some admitted, and yes, they are admitted terrorists, who have taken up arms and committed acts against the United States of America and her interests overseas, where are we going to house them? The floor is yours, my friend.
Well said. You are certainly a great public speaker. A few issues that I'm going to raise from your opening there, and I'm going to certainly address the question that you have presented. This is an issue that we've talked about before, where do we try them, you know? They haven't committed a crime on domestic soil, so to bring them in court of law on American soil is not an option. Where do we send them? And this is the main reason for why so many people are currently being detained at Guantanamo and not being shipped back, because, like you said, they have nowhere to send them. Now, my issue that I will raise is going to be that they never should have been there in the first place. And the fact that we have them there now has created all these problems, and my solution, or my response there is a solution to the problem, but it will prevent us from being in a situation in the future, and that no one else should be brought to this camp, as we get into this position where we can't charge them with a crime, and we've got nowhere to send them. So it certainly does create a problem. And by closing this camp, well, obviously it prevents this from happening in the future. You ask the question, where do we send them? Well, there is no simple solution to this. Can we keep them here? Do we send them there? You know, I'll be honest, I don't think there is a simple solution or an easy answer to this question, and it would certainly be my biggest hurdle to overcome with this in supporting why it should be closed. But when confronted with some of the operations that happen at Guantanamo and some of the allegations that are made of practicing that are happening there, And I'm sure we're going to get into the torturing aspect, which we have opposing viewpoints on. I really think that it certainly outweighs the situation we're presented with, where do we send them. Now, my other issue is with, we talk about how we do not charge them, because they're not committed a crime against un-American soil. However, we detain them. So if we're going to deny these people their freedom, but yet we're saying they're not guilty of a crime on domestic soil, then that's just, it's just a mindset that I'm not of, and I just cannot support any naval base or detention camp or however it is, maybe naval base, because it's in my face from extreme, which is a misquote. However, I just don't think that these people should be being held there against their will, if not being charged with a crime. Now, the question that I pose to you is that you've boldly stated that every person at Guantanamo has raised arms against Americans and deserves to be there. Are you of the mindset there is not one possibility that there is one innocent person at Guantanamo Bay currently or in the past?
And I'm taking that means that's my turn. All right, to answer your question, Chisler, I'm not going to say that there's not one there that's not innocent. Of course not. The American system, just like every system all across the world, it is flawed. And at times we do convict and we do imprison innocent people. That's a fact of nature. There's no getting around that. With that being said, there is no perfect system. So we can't just, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You can't completely disregard the system that we have in place simply because mistakes are made. What we're looking at here is the possible, in my opinion, political suicide of President-elect Obama. If he steps up and shuts this base down, first off, he's going to figure out where to put these people. Second off, you're saying, and I like what you said initially, that they should never have been there in the first place. But again, Chisler, again, the same question rears its ugly dragon's head and looks us dead in the eyes. If they're not there, where would we put them? We are at war. Like it or not, it is a war on terror. I don't like that whole concept. I don't like the fact that we're at war with a non-entity. But we are. It's just a fact of life. We have declared war against the terrorists that would do harm to the United States of America. During wars, prisoners are taken. It's just the way things are. I don't like it. It's how they are. Since you're taking prisoners, we have to put them somewhere. Guantanamo Bay was deemed to be the best of both worlds. It is American soil. It is fairly close to the United States, and yet it is not within our continental borders. So we're not bringing terrorists over here and the potential for them to escape and do more harm once they're within the borders of the domestic United States. I think the main question that Barack Obama has to ask himself and the main question that I'm going to ask you, and you said there's no easy answer, it begs an answer, Chisel. We have to have an answer as where do we take prisoners of war? And there may not be an answer, but it must be answered. It demands itself to be answered. And the reason there's a demand for an answer to that question, Chisler, is because people are demanding this place be closed. If there wasn't an issue of closing Guantanamo Bay, then the issue of where we're going to put the prisoners would never be an issue because we have a valid, good, solid place to keep prisoners. And I'm sorry that there were incidents there that people look upon as torture. But to me, stacking naked men up in a triangle and taking pictures of them is horrendous, absolutely and morally objectionable. But it is not torture. No, it doesn't even come close to being defined as torture. Gitmo works. Guantanamo works. It is working. Once again, they're not going to be in my backyard. So where exactly are we going to put them? So over to you to your closing, Tiffany.
Well, a few points. On the topic that we say it works, well, it works because we're left uninformed. It works because we don't know what's happening there. And by being kept out of the loop, then we're left with this naive assumption that it is working. And frankly, I don't think it is. You've talked about how closing Gitmo would be crippling to the Obama administration. I disagree again. It is a step towards exactly what Obama is promoting and looking for that, you know, that culture change that we've been kind of inundated with for the last 10 years. It seems like, that hasn't quite 10 years, but since 9/11, you know, Bush came out, I'm a war president, I make decisions with war in my mind, and we've been given these scare tactics that we've just been hammered with time after time, and I think that with Obama we're going to start to get out of that. We don't want to get this false sense of security, but we shouldn't live in fear every day, and I think that that's what's really progressed a lot of these things along that we've seen, such as Gitmo and the Patriot Act, among other things, that, you know, these things happen out of fear. And we shouldn't be making these decisions out of fear. What should we do to them? Well, if we have nowhere to send them, then send them home. Send them back where they came from. And if they're at immediate risk, where we've talked about these Chinese men, that they would have been slaughtered, then obviously we can't send them there. But we need to make a decision on where to send them, and send them somewhere where their immediate health is not going to be jeopardized. The argument that's going to come back is, well, what if they commit further terrorist actions against America? Well, after we release them, it is the government's duty, once again, to protect Americans. So to say that we cannot release them in fear that they may attack again, no, we've got a job to defend. So we can't keep them in fear that they may do something in the future, because we're keeping them without offering a charge. We're keeping these people without any idea of when they could possibly be released. So if I were put in a cell without any idea of when I'm possibly getting out, that in and of itself is torture. And that in and of itself is the reason why Guantanamo Bay should be closed, because it is denying human rights to people that deserve them, regardless of what they're guilty of. We can throw this title of terrorist on them and immediately think that they're terrible people. I disagree. I think that they should be offered these rights. I think Guantanamo Bay should be closed. And I think we need to make a decision on where these people should go. If they can go home, let's send them home. If we can't send them there, then let's send them somewhere where they can be safe. If we can put someone in a courtroom and legally put them in prison on a term sentence, albeit a life sentence, 10, whatever, give them a term of when you will be released and let them serve time for the crimes they are guilty of. If we can't charge them on domestic soil, well, I would rather see us rewrite our laws where we can charge them and give them a term sentence rather than leaving them in a cell with no term.
Okay, along the lines of what you're talking about with an uninformed public, and this is my closing, ladies and gentlemen, the public should be uninformed in a lot of ways. And look, I say that knowing that I'm going to get strikebacks on that. And if you disagree with anything we say, of course, send us a U2U and we'll address it. But if you just take a look just on AboveTopSecret.com at some of the willy-nilly comments that come out, I'm not sure I want these people knowing what's going on. The fear is justified. These people picked up arms and they went into combat against the United States of America and her interests overseas. Their countries don't want them. The countries that do want them are going to torture them and behead them, so we keep them here just to keep them alive. And let me tell you this. Finally, in closing, my last comment is going to be this. If President-elect Barack Hussein Obama chooses to close Gitmo, and one, just one of those individuals, call them terrorists, call them enemy combatants, call them what you will, call them scum of the earth, that's generally what I like to call them, if one of them causes an international incident, causes a loss of life of an American citizen or the American interests abroad, what's going to happen to Barack Obama's presidential legacy? I can tell you what's going to happen. It's going to go right down the drain. And as for having us taking on the responsibility of watching these individuals as we turn them loose, imagine the manpower that's going to take. That would take more manpower and more financial resources than we're putting into the war currently in Iraq. It's impossible, folks. Look, finally, Guantanamo is a good place to keep these people, and it works. Leave it open. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard a crossfire between one of AboveTopSecret.com's most outstanding members and moderators, Chisler, and myself, Homer Fife. If you disagree with or you agree with whatever we say, please go on the on thread and leave us a little note, send us a U2U or an email, and we'll either respond to you or we'll get into it with you. And my thanks go out to Nevermore and Chisler and Expert 11. Nevermore and Chisler for helping me co-host the show while my partner Martin Bain is off on vacation having the time of his life. Expert 11 for always providing wonderful insight as to the politics of the day. Next week, people, you can expect the regular format of the show to be back, but I've enjoyed having my time here with you. This is Homer Fife.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at AbovePolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.